Our next speaker is Maggie Latourell, who's the author of this wonderful book, The Gift of Alzheimer's, New Insights into the Potential of Alzheimer's and Its Care. And I notice it's endorsed on the back by no less than Peter Fenwick, who says, a truly remarkable book that shows great insight and understanding and of inestimable help to anyone caring for someone with the disease. And this is based on her experience caring for her mother. And so this is another very significant aspect of our topic today. And Maggie's been working for 30 years as a holistic therapist and is also a specialist in kinesiology. So Maggie, floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here today. 50 years ago, I was sitting in this hall listening to Dr. Rolfe, probably along with Elizabeth and Peter, and we were all trained in transcendental meditation and receiving weekly teachings from the Shankaracharya. And I mention this because it marked the start of a new journey into spirituality and consciousness that profoundly changed and influenced my thinking and my being. And I've carried that with me, and I carried that with me to the journey that I took with my mother when she had Alzheimer's. And I actually wonder if I hadn't had that early exposure to these wonderful teachings, if I would be standing here now talking about this. So thank you to the Study Society as well. I decided not to do a PowerPoint today. I'm actually reading from a PowerPoint, but I want you to think about some of the things that I'm saying. So I'm going to be talking about Alzheimer's as a vehicle for gaining insight into conscious dying, the end of life, and beyond. Alzheimer's is a protracted end-of-life experience spanning many years. This gives us the opportunity to observe and study over time what's happening towards the end of life. Many of the profound changes that occurred in people with Alzheimer's are the same as those that occur in a much shorter time frame in people at the end of life. And I was reminded of this when I read Peter and Elizabeth's book, The Art of Dying. There's so many correlations between people at the very end of life and this protracted period that people go through with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is therefore a vehicle for increasing our understanding about conscious dying, the end of life, and the other world. Not only that, when we gain understanding about this, we come to realize that the same core principles apply to us all right now. So as we know, Alzheimer's disease causes changes to the brain, and this leads over time to intermittent altered states of consciousness. Now, I would like you to think about some of the questions I'm raising. Are people still able to think when they reach the stage they don't recognize their family or they're not able to speak? How can we find out what they're thinking and experiencing when their speech is limited? Can we influence what they're experiencing? And if so, how might we help to facilitate higher states of consciousness and a good ending? And might we gain from this too? So a little bit about the background. As David said, my mother had Alzheimer's, and she went through all the normal terrible stages that people go through. It was a nightmare for us all. But she reached a stage later on when things started to change, and I was particularly struck when she said, "It's difficult being," then she stopped and said, "Working between two worlds." And I thought, wow, a medical doctor or the nursing staff would have said, oh, she's hallucinating. But with my, background and interest in consciousness, I took this as a real clue to what lay ahead and validated her experiences and asked her to tell me more. And I think if I had dismissed this as a hallucination, that would have been the end of our story. There would have been no more. So I'll talk more about that later. But recognizing the importance of what she discovered, she instructed me to tell others. So I became her faithful scribe. I thought it was going to be for a few weeks, but actually it turned out to be 3.5 years. And I recorded our conversations, and an edited transcript of these form the heart of my book, The Gift of Alzheimer's. So I've selected some quotes from our conversations that add to our understanding of this transformational phase of life and demonstrate the wisdom my mother was accessing. I'll offer my interpretation of what she was saying and experiencing, and will also refer to recent research in the field of neuroscience that confirms what we found and helps to explain some of the phenomena we experienced. Finally, I'll posit what I believe is happening to people as they near the end of life, not only those with Alzheimer's, but everyone or most people. I'll suggest how we might engage with them to help to raise their state of consciousness, and how we can enter into a symbiotic relationship in which we can also learn from them. Before I go any further, I want to clarify confusion that many people have about Alzheimer's and dementia. Alzheimer's is a subcategory of dementia. It actually accounts for about 62% of all dementias. And different types of dementia present very differently. So if your experience of someone with dementia is very different from what I'm describing, it may be they didn't have Alzheimer's, like my mother, but a different type of dementia. I also want to just emphasize that the early stages were perfectly normal in terms of the chaos, and it was only when my mother reached what the medical world calls stages 6 and 7, which are the last stages that I'm going to be talking about, because that's when the transformation really started to happen. And one day, I was with my mother. She hadn't been very well. I decided to extend my stay. I actually cancelled my holiday to be with her. And looking at her, I couldn't but feel compassion. She was so frail, and being so graceful and dealing with her circumstances. And as I was feeling that, she said to me, "You love me." She picked up the feeling that I had. Now, I should maybe explain that there hadn't been an awful lot of love between my mother and me throughout our lives. She had been, she would have been diagnosed as bipolar. From when I was born, she had postnatal depression. So our lives had been very shaky throughout. There wasn't a lot of trust there, which makes this, our journey, all the more profound. But when she said, "You love me," she was empathizing with me. And this is where some of the recent neuroscience comes in. A team at the University of California, San Francisco Memory and Aging Center, did some research into people with Alzheimer's. And much to everybody's amazement, they found that the more cognition decreases, the more damage there is to the temporal lobes, the more empathy increases. And there are other examples. When my mother said to me, "You look pensive tonight," I can tell everything through your eyes, every expression, every feeling. I've never seen such love coming from anyone's eyes. So you can see there was a lot of love was growing between us. The same research team found that not only do people with Alzheimer's empathize, as time goes on and their brain function declines, their empathy increases. And they found that they do something that they term emotional contagion. That means they sense what's going on around them, and then they feed that back. And the more brain loss, the more damage, the more emotional contagion there is. I'm taking this a stage further. If the neuroscientists have found that there's emotional contagion, I'm arguing that there's also subtle energy contagion. at this stage. My mother said, when you see little bits flying off, you'll know it's me. And this is exactly what mediums and psychics say that they see when they're tuned into people who have already passed on. And I was thinking, she imagined herself when she's died. And then she immediately said, I'm not dead, it takes time, I'm not ready yet. She read my mind and she answered. It really took me by surprise. Another example of energy contagion. As a healer, I frequently tuned into her energy field and just sent her light or peace or calm, love. And one day when I was doing this, she said, Margaret, I'm Scottish, so I was called Margaret. Margaret is home and I am home. You are there and between and joining. Our energies are connected. I was speechless. I couldn't have described what was happening more succinctly myself. And this is somebody with stage 6 Alzheimer's, who's supposed to have no brain cells left. On another occasion, I was sending her healing energy, and she said, a rush of illuminations, lots of light. So she always picked up when I was tuned into her field and tuned into her and sending her energy. So it's worth remembering that you don't have to speak, that people at this stage pick up from the field, and they experience that. So talking about energy, subtle energy contagion, healing and extrasensory perception happen through subtle energy contagion. The human energy field, as we know, holds information about the person's physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual aspects. I posit that the findings in neuroscience about emotional contagion apply equally to the other bodies or levels in the human energy field. I also posit that brain damage actually enables greater access to the information held in the various levels of the human energy field. It seems the right hemisphere is the portal to subtle energy fields, and this is enabled when the left hemisphere is disabled. I don't have research papers on this, but I think it would be a very interesting research to carry out. Moving on now to memory. People have spoken about memory this morning. And emotional memory. She said, I'm remembering all the difficult times, all the people. Emotional memory remains intact right to the end, even when short-term memory has gone. And this was discovered by Professor Oliver Turnbull at Bangor University. When he was researching people with Alzheimer's and memory, he found that they continue to learn emotionally. And this was exactly what I experienced with my mother, although this research hadn't been done at the time. When we acknowledge that long-term memory remains, it means that things good and bad from the past are still around and may need to be addressed and healed. And I encourage people to not to walk away from that. We can still help people at this stage if they're distressed. And I suspect that a lot of distress in care homes is repressed emotional memories coming to the surface. As Carl Jung said, forgotten or repressed material surfaces in a state of diminished consciousness. And that was what was happening. She also said, I'm a bad person. Was I a good mother? These were really difficult questions. And probably my presence triggered these questions. So I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm not saying you have to be a psychotherapist to do this, but it probably helped. And mostly what I said was, we all do the best we can at the time. Otherwise, we'd have done something different. And it's easy in retrospect to look back and wish it had been different, but it's different now. And that seemed to be enough for her to let go and move on. Something else I discovered is that we often hear the truth from people with Alzheimer's. "You have lovely teeth," she kept telling me. "And don't say it so reluctantly," she said when I said something she didn't like. Now, in normal brain function, we have a thought, we monitor and filter that thought, and then we speak. We'd be in quite deep trouble if we didn't do that. But in Alzheimer's, it goes straight from thought to speech. And that means that this filtering process just is absent. I'm going to summarize what I've just said, because there's quite a lot of information here, and it has implications for everyone. Empathy increases, emotional contagion increases, subtle energy contagion increases, emotional memory remains, emotional learning continues, and thought is unfiltered, we hear the truth. Knowing this has huge implications for all those involved with people with Alzheimer's and those at the end of life. What we are feeling will be communicated at a subtle level and then fed back to us. So we have a huge responsibility to manage our state, be aware of what's happening in ourselves, so that we can be there to facilitate the best possible state for the person we're with. Moving on now to other worlds, I said earlier she said it's difficult working between two worlds, and that this could have been, if it had been dismissed, I would stop talking now. But when people reach this stage, I call it the stage of surrender. They don't have control of their lives anymore. They've no choice but to surrender. And this is when most family and carers and people sort of give up hope. It's where the film Still Alice came to an end. Now, if there are any filmmakers here, I would love to make a sequel to Still Alice, because there's a whole other story to be told. It's in this state of surrender that people can experience expanded states of consciousness and access the other world. And it's very important that we recognize when this transition is happening and help to support people through it. Sometimes she was between two worlds. "When I leave, where will I go?" That's my question. But she also said other interesting things. "I need to get my energies in the right position. I'm getting everything ready in a position for starting." Starting suggests prior knowledge of a process. "I'm getting the markers in place for the move." Move to where? And then latterly she said, "I've got everything in place, everything done." So she was on a journey and she knew it. She had a portal to the other world. "I think of something, anything, and take it from there." Television. So her third eye was her television. And that was open. And I think that because her brain function was so limited, it actually enabled more activity in her third eye. And with the third eye open, we can talk now about thoughts and memory. She said, "I know my thoughts are clear. I'm confused when I can't remember. I think a lot." Remember, I asked you at the beginning, do people still think? Well, I believe they do. Even when, you know, they may be confused, repeating themselves, and we think there's nothing going on. I actually think there's probably a lot going on in the field. We were talking earlier about mind and thought. So my mother was differentiating between thoughts and memory. And it reminded me of the work of Rupert Sheldrake and non-locality of mind and extended mind. Thought beyond the brain. "It's amazing, the thought process. I feel well. I haven't felt like this for a long time. I've everything organized. It's nearly complete. I think a lot." When I said, you know, she said, "I have lots of thoughts." I said, "What thoughts? Tell me." "I can't. My brain doesn't work." So she had contact with deceased relatives. I could go on listing this for ages. And this wasn't within the last few weeks of her life. This went on over the 3.5 year period. "I have relatives visit me. They help me. My brother, who's had already passed over, asked me to visit him." And then she said something interesting. She said, I have Margaret and Fiona. Fiona was my sister who'd already passed over. And she said that as if we were together. And I really believe that in the other world, which she was tuned into, we were there together. She spoke about eternal life. We're learning we're immortal. You must tell others, which is what I'm doing now. Death is nothing to be afraid of. I'm at peace. I have no worry or fear. This is a woman who had suffered from anxiety, neurosis, all her life. Where I'm going, I will have your long hair. It's soft. Do you prefer brown or blue eyes? You have a choice. Anyway, I believe that dying can be an intelligent process. And my mother had, she had a sort of program that she went through three times. She talked about having operations. So these were energetic healing treatments where she described people taking things out of her mind and then she felt better. She had life reviews for learning from the past, and I helped her to process the information that was coming through that was troubling her. She had television programs for new learning. She had tests, supervision, and inspection. And this sequence was repeated three times over a period of 3 years. She became extremely psychic. In fact, I became absolutely transparent to her. I couldn't hide anything. It was quite unnerving. I'll give you one example of her psychic ability. My parents were in Scotland, and I was living in London, but I was commuting backwards and forwards very frequently. And one day, I was in London with a friend, and he said, where are you going? So I went on Google Earth and zoomed in on our family home, and there in the driveway was my mother's Mini. She'd always driven a Mini, but of course the car had been sold years ago, so it was an aerial photograph that was out of date. However, I go to the care home the next day, and the very first thing she says to me is, my Mini. So I wasn't thinking about her Mini, but that information was somewhere around. She had out-of-body experiences. The treatment's ended. There'll be no more. My head is not attached to my body. Help. She did astral traveling. I love to flow, the oceans, water. I do that often. And I had a little chat with her about astral travel because I wanted to validate everything she was experiencing. And the next day she said my brother, whose name was Graham, who'd already passed over, asked me to visit him, and I did. But I don't want to do too much. I thought, wise woman. There were many times when she exhibited amazing clarity of perception. This is usually termed terminal lucidity, but in my mother's case, it wasn't terminal because it went over an extended period of time. She was channeling. She actually said, I have to wait until some messages come through. Everything, my ideas, thoughts are from, I'll tell you that later. Oops. She had access to the Akashic Records, the Universal Information Field, the book. She, my late sister, read the book. The new book I have is useful. The library, lots of books, 8 books. And I hadn't been thinking about, I know about this, but I was just amazed when she came out with this information. And she alluded to past lives. There are many centuries. I don't know which one. She had altered perception of age. She was looking radiant, and I told her she looked lovely, and she said, I feel young. What age do you feel, 17 or 10 years older? She had altered perception of time. I have no past, present, or future. And people with Alzheimer's lose their linear sense of time. So past and future do roll into the present, but she was saying she'd no present either, so where was she? But this linear processing is a function of the left hemisphere, which is what has led me to think that when the linear processing is, you know, is not functioning well, that the right hemisphere has more opportunity for the creative and psychic information to come through. Moving on, she told me, I'm in my new home. you let me probe your mind. And she did. I mean, it was really quite, it was, how can I describe it? She used to stare at me, and rather than moving away from that, I tried to stay with that, and it was a real task. She said, call me the cleanser, and it did feel like a deep, deep cleansing, just being present in that space with her. And then she said, there are guardian angels all around me. Now, I should say, she hadn't been a particularly religious person. She only went to the Presbyterian Church of Scotland under duress, and she certainly had had no exposure to esoteric, you know, religions or anything like that. We're getting towards the end now. She's preparing to leave. She told me, it's good to have choice. I'm thinking about leaving. I'm very tired. A preview, peace and quiet. My dream, it's the climax. It's the end. It's peaceful. And I thought, that's so courageous to be able to dream about your own death. And I was very reassured, because I knew that when the time came, that it would be all right. Going home, she said, I'm counting the months. We can't go on forever. Things change. You're in the presence of kings and queens. And I did feel that there were many times when we were in a very sacred space. And I'll talk a little more about that later, because I think it's so important. Stages of dying. She said, I've entered the first stage. How many stages are there? I asked. 7. Which I thought was a significant number. Completion. I told you at the beginning we'd had a difficult, a challenging relationship. She said, we had a difficult beginning, but we've had a good ending. Margaret's done well. I'm happy at last. As if it felt that she was making up for what maybe I had not got in my earlier years. And I still find that quite touching. And about 18 months before she came to the end of this life on earth, she said to me, I didn't want to spoil your birthday. I thought, what's she talking about? She didn't spoil my birthday. My birthday is on the 21st of January, and she passed over on the 22nd of January. And I really believe that at some level, she knew, she planned, she didn't want me to associate my birthday with her passing. It was very considerate. So what's happening? If we talk first about the transmission of information, it seems that the brain acts as a receiver of information in the universal information field. The information someone tunes into in the field will depend on their state of consciousness at that moment. So which bandwidth, which frequency, which amplification? Just a few more thoughts here. Did she have a near-death experience? You know, I think it's quite possible. She didn't talk to me at the time, you know, when we got into this final 3.5 years. But it does raise the question, might people have undetected near-death experiences, especially, you know, at the end of life, when they go somewhere and they come back, and nobody has recorded that. So this world is, in this world, this physical world, it's a process of disillusion. Brain cells are damaged, causing a breakdown in physical and mental capabilities. I said earlier, you know, about the past and the future, move into the present, the loss of the individual personality and the ego. So the structures that have supported the ego and personality disintegrate, leaving the true essence of the person. And it's also a process of disillusion to transcendence, because being present in the now with no ego, according to Eckhart Tolle, is a transcendental state. And people with Alzheimer's have intermittent altered states of consciousness in which they may experience transcendence. And I believe this enables access to the other world. So Alzheimer's actually provides a bridge between this and the other world. I don't need to list all the wonderful things we associate with transcendence, such as deep love, enlightened thoughts, precognitive dreams, extraordinary light and visions. But let's look now at how we can help people to have a really good ending like my mother had. I believe there are four, maybe possibly more, core conditions that need to be in place. One is well-being. The person needs to be, you know, comfortable and well cared for. The second is compassion. They need to feel that the people caring for them feel compassion for them, and out of that comes love. And when you have well-being, compassion, and love, you have trust. And our relationship during that 3.5 years was built on trust. Communication. About 6 weeks before she passed over, she said, "You talk to me. Nobody else talks to me." That made me feel so sad, because she was in an excellent care home. The carers, the staff were very loving towards her. You know, people visited her. Nobody talked to her in a way that was meaningful to her. And what was meaningful to her was about subtle energy, about consciousness, about the other world. And because I listened and engaged with her in that process that she was going through, that was meaningful to her. So I have a little shorthand here, which is L-E-V in L-P. Listen, really listen. Engage with them in their world. Validate their world. It's real for them. Do this with integrity and, most of all, with a loving presence. Doing this enables people in a diminished state to feel safe, to surrender to this world and the other world, and experience expanded consciousness. Of course, with communication, Alzheimer's is particularly difficult. But you might find that if people are saying things that might sound a little strange, that they're speaking metaphorically. And I do encourage you to really search for the meaning in what they're saying, or even ask questions. I could give you many examples of metaphor, but one day my mother said, "Margaret left with something in her ear last night." And I thought, "What was in my ears?" I said, "What was that?" "The things I told her." Other people this morning have talked about the importance of music and singing, and I want to emphasize that too. You know, when the linear processing part of the brain doesn't function so well, the other part of the brain that deals with creativity, music, singing, art, crafts, poetry, movement — my mother had been a dancer — all these are people really come alive. They can be almost brought back to life when they are engaging in creative activities that uses that right hemisphere of the brain. A couple of other things that we can do is to hold a safe space to be present and consciously aware. And I mentioned earlier about sacred space. When Mum and I were together, we created sacred space. But when other people were around who were not aware of our special connection, I found it difficult to maintain this. And she was aware of this too. In fact, nobody else in the care home had any idea of the journey we were on. They thought she was a sweet old lady and I was a really dedicated daughter. That was it. So what did my mother teach us? She taught us that Alzheimer's provides many opportunities. It can be a vehicle for us to learn about the end of life, for accessing ageless wisdom, and engaging in conscious dying. The consciousness of the person will in part be determined by the consciousness of those around him or her. Meaningful communication can continue. Thought is independent of the brain. It's never too late to seek redemption. Dying can be an intelligent process. Help and guidance are always available. We just need to ask. The other world exists. It's just a different reality. A And love is at the heart of spiritual transformation. It's the gateway to the other world. But as my mother said, it must be experienced and felt. I'm going to end with some quotes, some of the beautiful things my mother told me that I want to pass on to you. She said, love is what it is. The stillness of deep love, I can't find words to describe it. I'm at peace. I have no worries or fear. We're learning we're immortal. Death is nothing to be afraid of. I love everyone. And love never dies. Thank you.